ExchangeWire's ATS Singapore conference returns on July the 2nd, featuring the latest insights from an exceptional group of speakers highlighting future challenges and breakthroughs in media, marketing, and commerce. Visit exchangewire.events to get your ticket now. And for an exclusive 10% discount, use the code PODCAST10 at the checkout.
Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Grainne Reid, ExchangeWire's Head of Marketing and your host for today. I'm delighted to welcome our guest this week, Uma Ranganathan, Head of Solution Development at Dentsu APAC. Uma will also be joining us on stage at ATS Singapore next week, speaking on the Optimizing Commerce panel. Uma, delighted to have you here today. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me, Grainne. Nice to be here. And I'm very well, thank you. Sunny Singapore never disappoints. Yeah.
Excellent. And alongside Uma today, we have John, ExchangeWire's Head of Content. John, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you. We recorded last week when I'd just flown in from Cannes, so I should be a bit more coherent today, I hope, in my discussion. But thank you for having me, as always.
Excellent. Well, in this episode, we're going to cover three key news stories that are shaking up the media and marketing industry. We are going to discuss Australia trials tech to ban under 16s from social media. The UK ad watchdog calls out ageist portrayals in mainstream campaigns, as well as Temu reboots direct sales to the US after a trade thaw with Beijing. So let's dive into our first news story. From December, in a world first ban, social media companies must prove that they are taking reasonable steps to block young people in Australia from their platforms or face a fine of up to $49.5 million Australian dollars, which is the equivalent of 36.99 million UK sterling pounds. The tech trial found no significant tech barriers to rolling out a software-based scheme, although there was no one-size-fits-all solution and no solution that worked perfectly in all deployments. So Uma, I'm going to come to you first on this story. Seeing that none of the solutions were found to work perfectly in the trial, how significant do you see this problem being?
Well, I think the thing is, you know, in today's day and age, young folks have literally sort of like grown up with social media, right? They're not even on the first wave of social media as we know it. They're probably already on what would be the second wave or the third wave, the Snapchats of the world, etc., right? And that has become their our equivalent of the schoolyard, where they find validation, they find friendship, they find interactions, they find entertainment, shopping, almost everything is there. The point is, we are now at a point where we realize that such early access to social media is having some harmful effects, and therefore it's imperative that we put some checks and balances around it. We are trying to put the genie back in the bottle. It will not go completely back in, for sure. But having said that, it is important that we try to get it back in as much as we can. Will there be some challenges in executing it, making sure that the ban that we are trying to implement works properly, you know, identifies the users correctly? What are the sort of like risks, right? I see two risks. One would be in the space of effectiveness, right? Ensuring that it is actually stopping the young folks and they're not utilizing other methodologies like VPN, et cetera, to still sort of like circumvent it and get on. But that exists regardless. And that should not be the reason why a ban or a regulation of some sort, I wouldn't even call it a ban, a regulation of some sort should not be put in place. And the second and more imperative danger would be the collateral damage of this particular regulation, which gathers a lot of information, first party privacy data about young folks, which is then going to be there forever, and the risk of misuse or compromisation of that information, right? So that's probably a bigger problem to solve. But that's like having the bogeyman and saying, hey, you know, this could happen and that could happen, and therefore we'll never start, which I don't think is the right approach. Again, knowing what we know about the impact of social media leading to also having negative effects on mental health, cyberbullying, and situation, you know, sort of problems such as that, some regulation is definitely, necessary.
Yeah. John, are you kind of in the same mindset as well. Just obviously regulation is needed. And are there any other additional problems that you're seeing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Uma, you used the phrase putting the genie back in the bottle. I had putting the toothpaste back in the tube in my notes. So I think we're on the same line of thinking there. I agree with all you've said in terms of, you know, the issue is that people are social, you know, native to social media now. They have grown up living it. And it's, I think, one of the most difficult points is having that taken away from them and how that comes across. You know, for the users, it might seem a bit draconian, but it's important to do it. I think the regulation of social media is incredibly important. It's, you know, these platforms can be very damaging. They give access to a wealth of content that people shouldn't be viewing at certain ages. It's, Pandora's box well and truly open on social media. So I applaud the efforts to regulate. I do worry that the two kind of provisos that have been put in here, that not all the solutions are working all the time, and also the over-collection of data will just be used as loopholes in order to not have to regulate the platforms. I think that'll, you know, if this ends up being tried, tested, used, I imagine these are the points that the social platforms will hang their hat on in terms of still providing their services to a younger audience. But no, I believe the regulation is incredibly important, and it's an interesting testing proving ground for the rest of the world that Australia are doing this. I think it will be very interesting to see how it goes. But there will be a lot of twists and turns on the way, I imagine, given these two fairly, I mean, the over-collection of data loophole is really significant, actually, because, yeah, while trying to stop young people seeing inappropriate content and having, you know, their lives and social lives damaged, by the platforms, you need to be very careful. You're not taking all the private data of young people. It's it is worth consideration. So I'm sure a lot more work will go into it. So I am positive on the outside that regulation is a good thing, and my concerns lie with how it will be proven and what the social platforms will be able to argue in terms of not having to do it. But no, good that it's being pushed through.
And you've both touched on the point of over-collecting of data. Do you believe that there's going to be privacy concerns down the line that we're going to see crop up? Uma, what are your thoughts there?
I think the challenge of in this particular situation would actually be the compromise of that particular data. I mean, so there could be two issues to it. One is, if it's compromised, how do we mitigate that? And how do we sort of like manage that? And the second is, how do we ensure that it is being collected for the right reason and not further sort of like, you know, utilized by the platforms or the marketeers, etc., to further monetize that information and not look at it as a great way to collect information, which after a certain point in time, it can be utilized because illegally then, you know, like at an age where they can be marketed to. So it's sort of like that self-regulation, which then the industry then has to bring into play. But like I said, right, we have to look at what is a challenge at hand at this point in time, and the issue of what could go wrong, and therefore not doing the regulation or not necessarily using this particular methodology of vetting and filtering out information to sort of like mark the age marker is not the right way, right? So, but these challenges will exist for sure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And John, Uma mentioned the use of VPNs, and obviously they're quite a common workaround. Do you think that this regulation would kind of set a global precedent, or is it exposing the limits of tech-led regulation?
Both, possibly. Like, I think it's definitely, you know, the eyes of the world should be on this in terms of their own regulation and how it works out. I mean, the VPN question is, yeah, I mean, kids are incredibly tech savvy, and you fear that if they want to access, they'll find a way around. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No question whatsoever. And that's, you know, that's par for the course, though. That doesn't mean that regulation isn't important. The fact that people, individuals, can bypass it does not negate the need for it whatsoever. It should be watched very closely, what's happening in Australia. Like I said before, it's a proving ground. It's an interesting test case for how the EU, how the US can govern social media platforms more effectively and make sure that people aren't being damaged in the long term by them. It is, there must be a privacy first way of doing this. that there has to be, you know, they've said, the commissioner said in the report that they are pleased that the trial suggests age assurance technology, when deployed in the right way and likely in conjunction with other techniques and methods, can be private, robust, and effective. So they know they can do it. And without, you know, there's clean room tech that could be used here. There's ways of safeguarding the information that they take and to assure the ages without it becoming, you know, stacked in a, like you said, Amy, like, you know, stacked in a data box and used for marketing later down the line. There's better ways to do this. And you have to think that they will look into it and find it. So fingers crossed that that it works out. But yeah, the eyes of the world should be on this Australian ban. We've been reading about it for a year now, and it is interesting, and I'm keen to see how the rest of the world reacts to it, rest of governments look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously there's a lot of time. We've got 6 months between now and December when this is meant to be coming into effect. So maybe some workarounds can happen between now and then. And I'm sure everyone will be following closely.
If the world could bring in the ban globally before my daughter hits the age where she's using social media, I'd be absolutely delighted. Thank you very much, social media platforms and governments.
It just lets you off the hook as a parent, right?
It's bad enough that she knows the difference between Disney and Netflix at 4 years old. I don't want her to be Snapchatting. Mm-hmm. So if we can just ban it all, I'd love it. Thank you.
Let's hope you've got a couple of years until social media is put in front of her.
But fingers crossed.
Yeah, definitely. We'll all be watching closely for sure. Well, let's move on then to our second news story this week, which saw the Advertising Standards Authority, or the ASA, had criticised brands for ageism in advertising. This comes as the UK watchdog criticised an ad by Scottish-based Throckmorton Foods over an offensive portrayal of older people as grumpy and intolerant, as well as implying that they are lonely and isolated. Uma, do you think there's a problem with how older people are represented in advertising?
Yeah, I mean, I think marketing as a industry is inherently ageist, right? In the sense that all brands want to be young forever. Generation after generation, the consumers grow old, but the brand never does. It's forever 20 or forever 25 or wherever they get stuck. And to that extent, there is always the portrayal of, you know, from a storytelling kind of like a point of view, there is always ageism, and there are certain qualities that is associated to drive home that point in storytelling where you are not this, but you are this. And I saw a really great, and sometimes it works well. I saw a really great ad, if I may reference that. It was an H&M ad, and it said, it had a really sprightly silver-haired woman, you know, sitting, and then it says, it said something to the effect of, not like a grandma, more like a girlfriend or something like that. Now, it's just a reference to context, right? But it still showed that lady as being extremely desirable, well-dressed, etc., right? So when ageism is used as a storytelling plot, as a reference to context, sometimes cleverly, it's fine. But when it is doing it with associating very negative qualities, lonelier, uglier, undesirable, etc., that's when the problem starts. And for by and large, I think marketers sort of like fall into that lazy creativity of using ageism just from a storytelling plot. And sometimes from an economic point of view, if they're also being ageist in targeting, older or mature consumers by only marketing things that they think that these mature consumers will buy, like certain products or services, and then they're doing themselves a big disservice in really identifying what the potential of mature consumers in today's world are. They're the ones with more money. They are living healthier lives. They're living longer. They are more brand conscious. They are getting fairly socially savvy and online shopping, etc. So that's a bit of a marketing fallacy. So in both fronts, I think the marketing world can do better in recognizing and understanding that, you know, ageism is not something that's working in their favor, and they need to relook at this.
Yeah. No, definitely. And to that point, like John, we saw that nearly half of over 65s were saying that they rarely see people like themselves represented in ads. Do you think the industry is missing a huge commercial opportunity as well as cultural responsibility here?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's Uma hit the nail on the head for me in terms of like the lazy stereotyping across the board of, you know, we put people into their bubbles and that's how we portray them on screen and in adverts. But yeah, I mean, it is the older people have the spending power for a start.
it's a massive
area that you're missing out on. If you're making people look like they're doddering old idiots in your advertising, and that, you know, the stereotype of an old person not being able to see the right bus and stuff like that, it can be offensive. And I understand the article. Having them as grumpy old people who don't like young people, like, why would they spend their money with you? Why would they buy? They're savvy consumers. Like, people aren't old in the same way they used to be. I don't know if that makes sense, but, you know, we have, like, the older generation now are tech savvy. They are consumers. Like I say, they have the earning power. And yeah, to portray them all as you know, grumpy old idiots is a very poor way of advertising. So I can understand the complaints. I think we see across the board lazy stereotyping still in advertising, despite, you know, we see some of the campaigns and they're the ones that are gilded with Cannes Lions Awards at this time of year. They are, you know, they come in for all the praise when they are aiming themselves at a more diverse audience, making older people models in their adverts. Dove, I know, do a very good job of trying to promote this kind of diversity from what we've seen, but it's, yeah, first and foremost, as a marketer, you're missing a massive swathe of money if you do this. It's it's ridiculous.
Do you think brands then can realistically move beyond tokenism when addressing age representation? Anuma, like, does true change require shifts in who's behind these campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, I think that will really come from when they start seeing an economic value in the mature sort of like consumers, right? Like John said, they are, you know, they're living longer, they're staying as your consumers. So when you start looking at your market and realizing that your consumers are, there are some segments or pockets of them which are also mature consumers, and they need to be represented correctly and do this segmented marketing, that's the opportunity. And then when you are able to sort of like, you know, have the right insight about them, talk to them directly, then you as a brand, as a marketer, can really grow and see the value of really addressing this particular segment. And I think we are at possibly at some kind of like a curve at right now where brands are starting to see that. Like I mentioned the ad before, for a brand like H&M to have that, I thought was interesting, because otherwise it's always these really swelled young 20-somethings in the ads, right? But then recognizing that they're also being worn by a particular set of women who are mature, also in the market for formal wear, to me was very refreshing to see. Yeah. And represented John, very nicely. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
No, that's great. And good to see. And John, have you got anything to add to this?
It's just, yeah, I think just to reiterate on that, the side of those stereotypes, and it's good, you know, I'm pleased on the one hand, Uma, that you've seen a campaign like you said that, you know, has appealed and has really done good work in knowing its target audience. And like you say, it's not, you know, just svelte 20-somethings. It's, you know, it is targeting an audience that it knows are its market, which is really good. I suppose the shame is that you noticed it, that it isn't just par for the course, that it's, you know, that it has to be a standout at the moment. But hopefully it will, you know, we're seeing change. And gee, to your point regarding whether it's the people making the ads that has to change. Yeah, it's, you know, you need fresh eyes in the industry. You need people who understand the market to be able to advertise effectively to it, not just think that a grumpy old lazy person is, you know, a grumpy old person who can't see properly is a good way of advertising, because you're missing the market. And so, yeah, fresh eyes always welcome in the industry and can only lead to better advertising, I think.
How can measurement frameworks evolve then to try and track how age inclusive campaigns are? So, like, similar to how things have progressed with gender and race representation. Uma, have you any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think, again, like, you know, as it is with all sort of like consumer identification, it's a parameter, right? I mean, age is another parameter. Like, gender is a parameter, or socioeconomic status is a parameter. So just recognizing that, you know, using that as a parameter, and like John sort of like said earlier, looking at those segments of audiences and expanding your creativity, your targeting, your effectiveness in a broader segment and sort of like making them individual independent segments of their own will throw better light on how you're doing against that particular segment now, which is just an expansion of your audience. So it's just another parameter for me with respect to measurement, etc. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, like the ASA shining light on this has brought it to the attention of consumers. And let's see if it's if we see better ads in the next while.
Can we also put the idiot dad trope in the bin as well? That's my personal pet hate is advertising when the bloke is stupid and whacks himself on the thumb with a hammer and it's, you know, it's hilarious and he can't do anything. It's it's lazy stereotyping and I am cross with it myself. So let's bin that as well.
That can go into that bucket too. That's no problem.
I'm solving all my problems today. I love this.
Yep. Therapy on the MadTech podcast.
Thank you. That's what I'm here for.
Great. Well, our third news story this week is about Temu, which is owned by China's DD Holdings, and it resumed direct shipments from China to the US after a trade deal framework was agreed on. The move reverses a recent shift to local fulfillment due to the end of the de minimis rule, which has allowed duty-free entry for low-value goods. Temu has seen a 47% drop in Q1 earnings and faces similar regulatory challenges in Europe, where new fees on low-value imports have been considered. So, what do you make of this current outlook for budget retailers such as Temu? Uma, what are you thinking?
I mean, the reprieve is great, right? I mean, it was a bit of a crazy tariff scheme that was sort of announced and, you know, with not too much of a roadmap in place or anything like that. So not very surprised. But the point is the reprieve is just a reprieve at this point in time. So it's a bit of a win-win situation. So what it has sort of like restored back is for the platform, it's opened up the access again. So Q2 and Q3 should go better than what their Q1 numbers look like because of the ban. For the consumers, now they have an access back again to these platforms to access those low cost, high value, or sort of like bad value products, especially in the highly sort of inflationary economy that we find ourselves in. The third win, which typically is the framework, right? It's supposed to be a win, 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 which the third win should have been for the platform. Unfortunately, I don't really think is a big win. It's a sort of like a very temporary win. Why? Because the unpredictableness that still exists because of the current pausing of the tariff and not necessarily a resolution of what's going to happen in the tariff space, which basically then means that they still have to figure out a midterm to long-term strategy on how they're going to solve this problem if instead of the 145% tariff that it was announced earlier, it still sort of like falls somewhere 30, 40, 50%. How do they change a strategy on sourcing, warehousing, supply chain? So all of those issues still exist. So it's a bit of a short-term win for the platform, in my opinion. But back to status quo is good for the short-term now.
And Uma, what do you think like a mid or long-term strategy would look like?
So the challenge is that for all platforms such as Temu and its like Shein, et cetera, there is a continuous regulation that they're facing, not just in the US. The US has just called it out and put it out there. Like you said, I think Europe is looking at it and other markets are looking at it. So they do have to figure out a way of placating and figuring out how they can enter these markets on a little bit more of an even playing ground, which means that they will have to definitely production on manufacturing is not something that they can take out of the market that they're in, right? So that's the advantage. And no other market's going to open up and help them with manufacturing facilities and which could keep the costs down. So the next thing that they will have to then do is possibly placate with respect to supply chain and warehousing, which then brings the products in, does a little bit of value-added duties being paid, etc. So just find that happy medium, which is not as low cost as what it is right now, but not as high cost as what a tariff kind of like a regime would impose on them. And then that becomes a new normal, which then, you know, which is acceptable to the consumer, the platform, as well as the governments, which have to put these in place to keep their economy going and their sort of like, constituents happy.
Yeah, no, absolutely makes sense. And John, how do you see the current landscape evolving for these budget retailers in today's market?
It's a really hard one to talk about because it could have all changed in the next couple of days. Like, you never, it's like volatility's taken on a new kind of a new meaning since January this year. It's incredible. The back and forward and the snap decisions that are being made that have a global impact on businesses like Temu. I think Uma's, brought up a really interesting point about the stability needed here, like in terms of, you know, the supply chain and how that's going to work with the tariffs. I don't know how budget they can remain in the long term. Like, I don't think there's a sustainable future either in the, you know, the environmental term of sustainability or business term in selling goods that cheap when tariffs are so high. And it's currently like it's a moving feast how their business is being run in terms of their relations with the US. It is, very, very tricky to predict. But I wouldn't expect to be buying things for a cent in US. I wouldn't be expecting to buy a picnic table for 2 cents for very much longer. I don't know how that works in the long term when with all this happening. They've talked about products that they're selling that are actually based in the US and production's based in the US, which is interesting, but it doesn't come with the same price tag, obviously. So that's a way around it, is starting to sell more goods from domestic sellers. I can't really imagine how it's going to go. Like I say, when everything seems to be, you wake up in the morning and it's everything in the world's been upended. So, I imagine it will not. Prices will rise, but in the name of stability, but we'll see.
And obviously, the aggressive pricing when things are a cent or a penny. What role then does brand trust play when we see the likes of Temu facing regulatory whiplash? John, anything on this?
It really does. And I think the rise of the budget retailers and the really, really low price retailers like Shein, I can never pronounce that. Shein and Temu, I'll try Temu. the rise of them has shown how little goods can be sold for still, how little they can produce for and how little they can reach the consumer for. But that comes with a trust issue, I think. And it does for me. Gee, you and I have spoken about this before. I'm looking for some nice running shoes. I know I've used this reference before, but I could get them on Temu for about £10 or less because of the deals they keep throwing at me with a little spin wheel of bargains. So I could get them incredibly cheaply. And somewhere inside me knows that they are probably made in the same factory as the big brand running shoes that I am going to purchase eventually for much more money, because for me, I equate spending that money with the safety of my ankles and the quality of the good I'm receiving. But that's built on years of kind of brand awareness, trust in a brand, and also a price tag. So can be produced and sold for that little, but brand awareness is always going to be incredibly important, and that brand loyalty, which sadly I have to brands that would like to charge me more than £100 for a good pair of shoes. Important, I'd say, G.
And Umar, are you on the same bucket there as John with brand loyalty being very important and brand trust?
So absolutely right. I mean, the brand is the one middleware which actually helps us to charge a little bit more for possibly the same product because of the trust element of it. Otherwise, all transactions, advertising or communication transactions would be just a barter system, at this price for this product, buy the cheapest one, right? But the minute you bring in a layer of a brand, then suddenly you're like, okay, I'm bringing in a value to it, and therefore, there's more trust, and this could differ for different product categories. Like John said, maybe he's willing to not be too particular about his party supplies for the weekend party, but when it comes down to buying his pair of shoes, which is going to protect his ankles, and there is a trade-off. So it'll impact on the basis of what kind of categories we are looking at and trying to be budget-focused versus brand-focused. And again, the second variable would be the target audiences. Younger audiences who have lesser money may not be necessarily that brand loyal because they just want fast fashion, use and throw, right? So because they don't have much, but they are already in a consumer space, they just have to stretch the dollar. therefore, brand loyalty is something that they can wait for when they have, they start working and have more of a discretionary income, etc. So there will always remain a place for both to coexist. I think the way we will look at it would be how it impacts us on the categories or the audiences, and they will coexist. Yeah.
No, it's a very good point. And yeah, like when you're considering buying a pair of running trainers that will retail at 150 plus pounds versus a pair that are a fiver or a pound or whatever it was that the deal was that John you saw. But no, I think that's a very good point. The lower priced items are a lot easier to fork out money for. But yeah, I guess it's just very turbulent times at the moment. Who knows what's going to happen here? And if we are seeing the beginning of the end for ultra cheap cross-border e-commerce, I guess we're just going to have to wait and see on that one. But yeah, thank you both for such a great discussion here. I think we can call it there. Uma, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts on this week's stories. And we're very much looking forward to seeing you in Singapore next week at ATS.
Likewise. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
And John, as always, thank you.
Thank you very much. Love that discussion. Thank you very much, Uma.
And thank you all for listening. That's it for the MadTech podcast this week, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the MadTech podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.